you like to reserve some rebuttal time, Mr. Holder?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
Certainly, nice, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Josh Holder, the Chesapeake Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Franchon Hunt. I want to start by making a brief comment. I noticed something noticeably absent in my colleague's reply brief, and that is any mention or argument against the statute or the wording of the statute requiring a hearing. And so for that reason, I'm not going to spend too much time on that unless the court has specific questions about the wording of the statute.
I'm assuming you're not abandoning that argument, though, are you?
I am not abandoning that argument whatsoever. I did not see that opposed in my colleague's brief. He argued instead three main arguments: procedural default, harmless error, and that the colloquy at the guilty plea discharged the court's obligation to hold a hearing. So I'll address those topics unless the court has specific questions about the wording of the statute. Regarding the procedural default, I filed a reply brief that I believe addresses that thoroughly. The cases that were cited were, for the most part, federal habeas cases. And Justice Harlan in the U.S. Supreme Court eloquently stated, very verbosely, I might add, in Mackey versus United States, the difference in the standards of review between a collateral attack and a direct appeal. And so for that reason, most of the cases that were cited by my colleague indicate that this was a procedural default because the matter was not raised at trial or on direct appeal. However, we're on direct appeal currently, and the issue is now raised. Furthermore, the federal habeas cases don't have any bearing on the interpretation or application of Rule 5A18 of the rules of the Supreme Court of Virginia. So for that reason, I think that his arguments and cases cited are distinguishable from the argument that I presented in my opening brief. I also want to call your attention, there's another case that I found in preparing for today, James versus Singletary, 957 F. 2nd, 1562, on page 1572, even mentions that Pate claims, such as the one being made in my first assignment of error, can and must be raised on direct appeal due to the nature of the claim and the fact that they are largely dependent on the record of the trial court. Moving to the next argument of my colleague, harmless error. In my research, there's two types of competency claims, a procedural competency error and a substantive competency claim. And under a procedural claim, it was James versus Singletary again, also cited in, I believe it was Medina, where they interpreted Pate as creating a rebuttable presumption that the defendant enjoys on a procedural competency claim, he enjoys the rebuttable presumption of incompetency. Because, especially in light of the specific circumstances here, once he's found incompetent, that state is assumed to continue until something else changes.
Wasn't there a change here when the doctor wrote the report saying he's now competent to stand trial?
Well, I don't believe so. And the reason is we've got one doctor, Dr. Zwemer, saying that he's incompetent. We've got the doctor from Eastern State Hospital, I forget her name, Outhouse maybe, opining that the defendant is now competent, so we now have competing expert opinions. That's what a hearing would flesh out.
Except the defense attorney apparently didn't feel the need for the hearing and effectively waived it by proceeding.
Well, Judge, I don't believe that the attorney or the defendant can waive a competency claim, but in fact,
the statute say you have to ask for the hearing?
The statute says that the hearing is not required unless requested by either party or unless the court has reasonable cause to believe that the defendant will be hospitalized. And that gets back to my argument about the wording of the statute. These statutes are somewhat confusing because 19.2, 169.1 is looking ahead prospectively for the initial competency eval. 19.21692, the eval's already been done, he's already been restored, and they say go back and follow the procedures of 169.1. So once he's been hospitalized, a hearing is required once the court has reasonable cause to believe he's hospitalized.
The error doesn't deal with the court failing to hold a hearing. It simply says proceeded to sentencing without making a formal determination. Your assignment of error, as I read it, means the court didn't enter the order saying he's now okay to go.
Judge, my assignment of error number one is the trial court erred in proceeding to accept appellant's guilty plea without conducting a hearing.
I apologize.
And without making a formal. So, and the reason I worded it that way, it is more or less to cover the basis because I do believe a hearing is required. But either way, once you have the initial determination that the defendant is incompetent and a subsequent evaluation after restorative services saying that he is now competent, we have competing experts. We don't have the luxury of having Dr. Swemer to give a updated report on his current status, which I believe would be very helpful in these situations because, from my experience, competency and sanity evaluations are very subjective. And I think the record fleshes that out when you look at Dr. Zwemer's findings and what he observed, Dr. Outhouse's findings, what she observed, and Dr. Nelson's findings, what he observed. There were a myriad of consistencies in the defendant's views. He had abandoned.
Wasn't the last report that the trial court had is that this defendant was competent to stand trial?
The last report was that he was competent to stand trial, despite the fact that it still found that he had auditory hallucinations. He still minimized his chemical imbalance, which is the same language that he used under Dr. Zwemer's report. I fleshed out a list here. So in all three evaluations, his vocabulary and sophistication of language, grasp of current events, and strong capacity for abstract reasoning, that was what Dr. Zwemer noted. And in each of the further reports, they say he grasps and understands the nature of the charges against him. However, there are other consistencies. He's had a consistent grandiose and persecutory beliefs. He simply swapped one belief and couched it in the Black Lives Matter movement. But that doesn't, and I'm not to attack the Black Lives Matter movement or any legitimacy there, but you know, he simply took his persecutory beliefs caused by his mental illness, wrapped it up in the Black Lives Matter movement because he abandoned his I'm a diplomat and they can give me a skin test and prove that I've got diplomatic immunity. He just found a more legitimate way to couch his persecutory beliefs. He consistently still believed that the evidence did not exist and that there was absolutely no evidence that could convict him. That was the same thing he told Dr. Swemer, that was the same thing he told Dr. Outhouse, and the same thing he told Dr. Nelson. He consistently believed that none of his attorneys were defending him, and that is consistent with the what he told Dr. Swemer, consistent with the hypothetical that he told that Dr. Swemer put him through, where the Commonwealth enters at trial no evidence of guilt, and the defense entered no evidence what would happen. He says, "I'm going to be found guilty because my attorney didn't defend me." He's got this delusional belief of what is required for a defendant to be found not guilty. And he held that belief through Dr. Outhouse's restoration report and Dr. Nelson's second competency report because he still said, none of my attorneys are defending me. None of them are doing their job. None of them are defending me. That's why I've been through so many.
That's pretty standard, even if they're sane. You know? We get those cases every day.
Granted. And, I'm a public defender. Numerous clients would always argue, well, you're not doing your job. You're not fighting for me. You don't care about me. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that they're delusional, but I believe with Mr. Hunt's history of delusions, the fact that even in the restoration report, he was still hearing auditory hallucinations. There's no evidence as to what those hallucinations were, their context, their strength, what they were telling him. And all along in Dr. Zwemer's report, he still said from the beginning, I've been hearing these since, you know, the early 80s, and I can ignore them. And that's the same thing he's telling Dr. Outhouse, and she's saying, oh, well, because he can ignore them, they're insignificant to his competency. These are the inconsistencies that a hearing would have flushed out.
But the trial judge had before him all of the medical reports.
Yes.
The statute simply requires that he determined whether the defendant is competent to stand trial. Why didn't the plea colloquy satisfy that requirement?
Judge, that was the similar instance to Pate versus Robinson of the U.S. Supreme Court. In Robinson, if I can get to the exact quote, on page 385 of the Pate versus Robinson case, the Supreme Court of Illinois held that the evidence here was not sufficient to require a hearing in light of the mental alertness and understanding displayed in Robinson's colloquies with the trial judge, but this reasoning offers no justification for ignoring the uncontradicted testimony, and there they did have some type of a hearing. And it goes on to say, while Robinson's demeanor at trial may be relevant to the ultimate decision as to his sanity, it cannot be relied upon to dispense with a hearing on that very issue.
But the judge is not just relying on the answers the defendant gives and his demeanor. He also has before him the reports of the mental health experts. So and we presume trial judges do the right thing, follow the law. The law is that you can't proceed to try someone who's incompetent. I mean, all of these things taken together leads to the conclusion that the trial court may very well have said, you know, based on the doctor's reports and what I'm seeing here, he's competent to stand trial, and nobody's asked for a hearing.
Judge, that's why I think the wording of the statute is so important. It's not required unless the judge believes that the defendant would be hospitalized. The defendant was hospitalized, therefore a hearing is required under the statute, so that it's an additional protection.
The trial court has is he doesn't need to be hospitalized now, right?
He doesn't need further hospitalization.
That could be, I can see where that could be one interpretation of that statute. However, I think that that ignores the checks and balances that were built into this system. I find it hard to believe that a greater standard will be used when somebody is at an initial competency hearing facing hospitalization, has never been hospitalized before, and yet we're going to use a lesser standard after they've been hospitalized for up to a year. The report says they're still having auditory hallucinations, they're waxing and waning, have a history of not taking their meds, and when they're off their meds, they could become incompetent again. That's what Dr. Allenhouse's report said. And so I think that a hearing is definitely required under the facts and circumstances of this case that the court had in the reports. For whatever reason, the court didn't order that hearing, and that's why I think that was an error.
Would the standard for our review be abuse of discretion?
I do not think it's abuse of discretion. The standard for that review is still a de novo. It's the interpretation of the statute as to whether it is required. If it's a ministerial duty, it's a ministerial duty.
It's a factual determination of whether he needs hospitalization, isn't it?
Once we have the hearing, it becomes a discretionary review. Whether or not we have a hearing and whether or not a hearing is required is not an abuse of discretion standard.
But the statute makes the hearing discretionary.
I don't believe it does. It only makes it non-discretionary when the court has reasonable cause to believe he will be hospitalized.
But
it then says it's required.
He had no reasonable cause to believe he needed further hospitalization. The reports didn't indicate that. And nothing that he saw or observed indicated that.
Well, one of the two reports at the time did not indicate that. At the time, because we had never had an evidentiary hearing, Dr. Zrumer's report is still part of the record, and now we've got competing experts, which is the reason a hearing would flesh out the differences.
Back to 5A18, somebody needs to tell the judge, we need to have a hearing on this because we have two reports that are contradictory.
Somebody probably should have raised that. I can't speak to that. I wasn't the trial counsel at the time. However, as the case laws that I cited states, that competency is something that cannot be waived, and therefore, under the ends of justice exception,
there's no evidence that he's incompetent.
Right. I believe there's still evidence that he's incompetent. When you, even after Dr. Outhouse's report, he's still writing the courts with such delusional statements as And this was on page 57 and 58 of the joint appendix. You know, the judge ran my guidelines, and this should be time, sir. Please send all my sentencing information to the DMV so they can release me. I mean, he's still incompetent. He still has no understanding or rational understanding of how the system works or what's going on. He's asking them to send sentencing information to the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Counsel, you have...
I've exceeded my time. So I think we've covered everything that I needed, including the court's colloquy was insufficient to discharge their duty. So with that, I'll say thank you.
Thank you. I think we understand.
Afternoon. May it please the court. On this first issue, counsel started off by resurrecting a quote that's in his reply brief from Justice Harlan, in which he set forth some principles that are plainly true and just as plainly have nothing whatever to do with the issues in this case. Namely, that there's a difference between collateral and direct review. We're now on direct review in this direct appeal. So somehow the cases that the Commonwealth has cited are distinguishable. Justice Harlan himself says that collateral review, such as habeas, is not a substitute for direct appeal. That's plainly true. The problem for the defendant in the present case, which his reply brief does absolutely nothing to address, is that the rulings in several of the habeas cases I cited confirm the default that occurred here. In the guilty plea portion of the case, which concerns the first assignment error, there were two competency reports beforehand. The first one, which was about 2 years before trial, concluded that he was incompetent despite, as the defendant says on brief, his strengths. The second report, which was a year later, found he was competent. And then a third report, only 3 months before the trial, concluded, like the second report, he was competent. So you have, at that point, and the trial attorney, who had been sufficiently motivated to seek the third evaluation in late 2016, and she never did it thereafter, which suggests she saw no need for it. But in any event, so 3 months after the final of the three reports, the defendant signs a guilty plea form, makes numerous representations attesting to his understanding of the ins and outs of the case.
Now, the statute requires that the court shall promptly determine whether the defendant is competent to stand trial. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't we require the court to follow that statute and at least make a determination either on the record or in an order that the defendant, he has already found the defendant incompetent to stand trial. Doesn't he need to supersede that order before he can proceed?
Two things, Judge Petty. One, I would certainly agree with you if the issue were before the court. The problem is it's not. It's plainly defaulted because, as I was about to elaborate on, he signs this advice form, makes numerous representations. The attorney signs, say, he understands everything. I'm satisfied he understands everything I've told him. Plea agreement makes other representations. Guilty plea colloquy makes numerous similar representations. But by the way, I think counsel at the very end of his argument made some reference to the plea colloquy being deficient. I don't think he's ever said one word about the plea colloquy being deficient. So, he pleads guilty pursuant to the plea agreement. The court finds the plea is valid. Not one word as of the time of the guilty plea hearing from counsel about the statute, about the need for a hearing. The only thing, ironically, that counsel said as of the guilty plea hearing that related to his mental state was to sign the advice form saying, I'm satisfied the defendant understands what I've told him and that this he can go forward and plead. So the words of the statute in the appropriate case would be well worth getting into. This is plainly defaulted as there are two death penalty cases from Virginia that illustrate that. One, Towns versus Murray made its way to the Fourth Circuit, and on state habeas, the Supreme Court of Virginia held that a claim was procedurally defaulted under the rule in Slate v. Peregrine, which is always the one at issue in federal habeas.
Well, given the fact that the trial judge made a finding that he was incompetent to stand trial, that finding, that factual finding in the order representing it, continued to be in full force and effect until something overrides it.
Well,
precedes it. So why is it incumbent upon the defendant to raise something that's already been litigated, adjudicated, and found?
Well, first of all, the first report was the conclusion of expert number one. I'm not sure that the judge did anything other than receive that. But I'm not sure that he did anything that amounted to a finding by the court. But be that as it may, several months later, the court, under the statute, said it appears he might be amenable to restoration of his competency. So, let's see, this is an order of November of 2015. The court ordered that he could be restored and directed for treatment. And in December of 15, he's admitted to Eastern State. 3 months later, Dr. Outhouse there files a report that he was competent. So that's the reality for the year going into the trial. The only thing that occurred thereafter between report number two by Dr. Outhouse is December 2016, which, again, is much more contemporaneous with the trial in the following March. Dr. Nelson again finds that he's competent. I also made the argument on brief that, and I've cited cases from elsewhere, this is sort of the ultimate practical test, or the rubber hits the road. The fact is, the defendant came to court, and he went through the normal plea colloquy. There were no red flags in the way of strange responses that were other than lucid. The defendant never engaged in intemperate behavior. Defense counsel never said a word at the guilty plea hearing, suggesting some concern. Neither did the trial judge, neither did the prosecutor. And at the end of this otherwise pretty typical hearing, the judge said, I find that you're entering the plea validly. I accept it, and we'll have sentencing. I would submit that that hearing, by definition, the judge would not have made that finding if he did not regard the defendant at that time as competent to enter the plea and to stand trial. Well, if that's the case...
Did the appellant ever raise the issue that we should have had? You should have given us a hearing?
Never. Never.
So isn't that a 5-18?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. But then that's why I started off my argument referring to counsel's reply brief, where he says undoubtedly correctly that collateral and direct review have different standards of review. Well, that's true, but beside the point. This is not a matter of standard of review. This is a matter of whether you have a default and whether the default is something...
Whether the issue was preserved.
Right. And a Burkett Fourth Circuit case out of Virginia held that both a substantive incompetency claim, i.e., the defendant's not competent, and a procedural incompetency claim, i.e. the judge either did something wrongly or didn't do something he should have done, they were both defaulted as per Supreme Court of Virginia habeas default rulings under Slayton v. Peregrine on state habeas. Towns, another death penalty case in the Fourth Circuit out of Virginia, one of the claims on state habeas and thereafter federal habeas was the defendant who'd represented himself pro se was apparently so upset by being convicted that the trial judge was required to do a new competency hearing before sentencing. The Supreme Court of Virginia on habeas held that claim defaulted because it hadn't been raised at trial or direct appeal. Fourth Circuit enforced that default. I don't think there could be any clearer but that you can default this kind of claim irrespective and notwithstanding the defendant's arguments that you can't default. Burkett Towns are perfect examples of same. So
let
there was
me get back to the merits for a minute. January of 2017, after the reports were received by the court. The court entered a scheduling, what appears to be a scheduling order. And he says in that order, because the defendant has been found to be competent to stand trial as the reason for the continuance from January 12th to February 28th, does that order satisfy the statute that the court shall determine whether the defendant is competent? This is on page 45.
Without even getting to it, I will tell you, I'm going to answer you, it's never been the subject of any argument by counsel.
I just have to look at it. And it's endorsed by both the attorney for the Commonwealth and the attorney for the defendant.
And the defendant. The defendant also has signed it on the right, middle right.
You're right.
And it also, and I think there's several other similar forms in the appendix, where the defendant purports to understand this and that. I didn't really get into them because I went into it in some length in the advice form and the plea agreement and the guilty plea colloquy in court. But again, another similar representation I understand, and the attorney in effect agreeing or ratifying that representation. It's certainly the first paragraphs where it says the defendant's been found competent to stand trial. That certainly, at the very least, suggests in the court's mind there's no current issue about that. And it could be that it's an allusion to report number two by Dr. Outhouse, which was in March. Well, wait a minute. No, this is entered after reports two and three. So this is entered shortly after Dr. Nelson submits report number three, and the latter two had found them both to be competent, so it may be sort of an indirect way of saying now that the court has these two reports saying he's competent, but either way, it certainly is something anything other than a finding that he's currently incompetent. Again, the court, by definition, could not and would not have accepted the guilty plea as knowing involuntary if it concluded that the defendant was currently not competent. It had to amount to, at the very minimum, an implicit finding of present competency. And again, I've cited several cases on brief, I think from elsewhere, maybe one from the Fourth Circuit. And here's one from Connecticut. The language is clear and speaks for itself. Implicit in the trial court's conclusion that the defendant was competent to plead guilty is its finding that the defendant was also competent to stand trial. So, I think the first claim is defaulted, and the only stated ends of justice argument, I think, is wrong under the law, which is that you can't waive an incompetency claim. I think Burkett and Towns, among others, show to the contrary, as do some of the cases I cited from the Fourth Circuit and I think either the Seventh or Ninth Circuit. Just briefly on the other claim about the denial of the sentencing motion to withdraw the plea, I might note that in contrast to several other cases cited on brief, there was never a written motion filed before the sentencing, so that the Commonwealth had some notion of it would have to address it. And
the only reason that he gave to withdraw is his lawyer gave him bad advice.
Well, he claimed that he had some understanding about the sentencing, that he would get no more than like 36 months time served, which, as the trial judge aptly pointed out, is totally belied by the record and his repeated representations that he understood.
But that's not raising a substantial defense.
No. In fact, it's interesting because counsel claims that alleged incompetency to stand trial is a quote-unquote defense. I think that is plainly wrong. A defense is like alibi, or I wasn't there, or I was in Cleveland, or whatever. And in fact, it's interesting, the Booker case of this court, which I cited on brief, in which it similarly found that there was nothing beyond a mere formal defense. It was not a sufficient, reasonable defense that you need to show as part of the two-part test to withdraw your plea, says at one point, while not meant to be exhaustive, examples of a defense that go beyond a quote-unquote merely formal defense include self-defense, alibi, insanity, or a defense based on a proffer of specific evidence that, if accepted by the fact finder, would defeat the prosecution's case. All of them have that in common. They would defeat the prosecution's case. Incompetency, as this very appeal demonstrates, is not something that, well, if it was true here, it's true here. I mean, it's transient. It may be an issue at one point and not an issue at another. So the only thing that he points to as a valid defense is simply not a defense within the meaning of the governing case law. So I think the court appropriately denied the motion to withdraw on that ground, as well as that it was not validly offered. I would note again that the defense attorney, who had previously been sufficiently diligent and attuned to the needs of her attorney and filed a motion for a competency report number 3, did not feel the need to file one at sentencing. About 4 times at sentencing, she couched it in terms of, well, my client has asked me to ask the court to withdraw his plea. I think the court, that is very different from the tone and substance of the attorney's comments and actions in, for example, the Hernandez case. I'd ask the court, for all of these reasons, to affirm. Thank you.
You did not have any rebuttal time left, but I will, given that it's been a long day, is there anything you'd like to add?
Could you, I want to address that, because okay. I did not see this and I would have brought it up earlier, but that scheduling order I mentioned where the court says the defendant has been found to be competent to stand trial, does that suffice as the court's finding of competency?
Judge, I'm forced to argue that I don't believe it is, but that's by nature of knowing how the scheduling orders are completed, that that was a handwritten order as such is typically not done following an evidentiary hearing.
But it says what it says.
It says what it says. And so that was something that was written out by the attorneys and signed by the attorneys, but there was no hearing, which is why I get back to the argument of the statute requiring a hearing. So that would be irregardless of what that order says.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
We'll come down and brief counsel.